I hope everybody had a good week.
Great ball season again. Today, actually, in New York State, it's a high holy day. You know what day it is?
Election day.
Very good. Who's it? 8-1. Okay. Today is election day, actually, in New York State. That's a very important day. You have to go out and do our civic duty. So for those of you who did not get the chance to vote, run out to vote after practice.
Okay. Polls are still open until 9 o'clock. Okay. Last time, we spoke about the importance of property. We spoke about the evolution of property rights. We spoke about the founders' view of property. We spoke a little bit about English legal history, and we capped it off with our friend Blackstone, who wrote his commentaries on the law. What is that also known as? What they call it? The Bible of the law, because it was, you guys know what you're doing. How far are you? Do you want to read? Remember our friend Blackstone, who rode circuit all over London, wrote those commentaries on the law. It was the first case law. That will become important as we go forward. Okay. Tonight, we're going to talk about the evolution of rights. We're going to talk about the evolution of property law. One of the things you have to know is the first postulate. There's four of them that we'll go through tonight. But the first postulate, which is the most important, is that property is a collection of rights, not a collection of things. It's the most important thing you will learn in this class, that property is actually rights. Because it doesn't matter who owns the property, it matters who controls it. The right to control that property is everything. You've heard the adage, possession is 9/10 of the law. Well, the reason that is if you possess it, you control it. You can't very well control something you don't possess. Sometimes actually you do, but it's a lot easier if it's in your back room. Okay. We're going to talk about the four postulates. We're going to talk about the Constitution and the Declaration and how they relate not only to rights, but how property rights are the foundational basis for both those documents. You cannot have freedom and liberty without property rights. The founders knew it, they put it in, and that's one of the things we're going to talk about. Okay, let's begin our adventure. Let's talk about what property is. Yes, it is something to possess. But how is it defined? Is it that desk you sit at? Yes, it is. Is it the pencil? Yep. Is it your car? You bet. Is it your house? Boy, you can't see that. That is actually my house. And not at night either. But anyway. Is it your puppy?
That is my puppy. Cute little thing. Get what her name is. Huh? No, they didn't name the dog after me. What was your name, your old dog? For those of you who are fans of Disney, Lady! Lady, that's when she was a puppy. She's now 14. Blind, one-eyed, and has a little bit of pride. But anyway, she's all right. The film's still just as cute, although she looks a bit like a pirate.
But anyway, your puppy, any animal,
is property. It's property the same as a lamb. There is a bit of difference under the criminal law, because if you break a lamb in half, you're not going to turn way better than your dwellings. But animals are property.
They're personal property. You can buy them, you can sell them. Okay? All these things are property. Almost anything tangible you can think of, and a lot of things that aren't tangible, are property. Let's go. What does Blacks define property as? Big definition. The right to possess, use, and enjoy a determinate thing. Any external thing over which the rights of possession, use, or enjoyment are exercised. Another definition, in its widest sense, property includes all a person's legal rights of whatever description. Boy, that's broad. So what does this mean? Let's ask Dr. Sprankley.
For those of you who happen to venture in the world of being a submarine, on the website is John Sprankley's books, at least selected versions of them, paragraphs. John Sprankley is one of the leading people with respect to property law philosophy.
And what does he say? He says, you got to understand property, you got to understand one thing, rights.
Rights are what controls property. You have a right in that property, you have the ability to control it,
that's what property means. Okay? You want to understand property, one word, rights.
His definition, which I think is rather elegant, the property is rights among people that concern things. The only thing you got to remember on that is the first part. Rights, the ability to control the property, is the ability
to do and exercise your right. Okay. But what's a right?
You know, as Americans, we grow up with the perspective that we all have rights. But do we ever really think of what that means? Tonight, we're going to talk about that. My dear friends, I'm talking from a legal perspective tonight, not a political. Because political discussions broaden the concept of rights. Legal concepts limit to three things. John Locke was the one who specified what those three things. Under law, you have three rights, and I dare say, ladies and gentlemen, only three. Right, liberty, and the pursuit of property. Those three things are your rights. All others are derived from that. Only those three.
They were enumerated in the Declaration and then later in the Constitution, but we'll get there shortly. You have the power and ability to control the property means you have a right in it. Okay? That's why our fundamental first postulate,
and you need to know these four postulates over and over and over again. Yes, he said. Okay? We're going to talk about it over again. But the first postulate was property is a collection of rights. Not a collection of things. Because if you don't control the property, it's pretty much worthless to you. Okay? And it's that right to control it, your
equit, which is exclude, possess, use, and transfer, that makes property valuable to you. Okay? The essential element which gives property its value is the ability to control it. And it's through this perspective of right that we're able to broaden our concept of property.
What does that mean? Property is not only that computer that you have in front of you, the cookie that you just ate, the soda pop, the hoodie, but all of that is much more than this. It's also intellectual property. If you have a fabulous idea on how to build a better mousetrap, that idea has value. You can get a patent. There are two holes patent in the world. Well, the certificate represents, not the patent, right? All right? Okay. Sorry. Okay. Intellectual property, that thought, performances, copyrights, trademarks, patents. They're all ideas, right? And as a result of that, if you don't hold them in your hand, that's why rights comes anywhere. Your right to control that story that you have a copyright on is what's important.
Also, you'll find out when we get to the area of real property, there's things called future interests. If I am a landlord and I rent you my building to live in, I have a right to get it when you move out, when your lease expires. That's a future interest. I don't have the right to live in it now because you do when I rented you that. I leased you that property. But that future right to come and get it is a right. I'm not in physical possession of that property. You are as a tenant. And future interests are also an intellectual concept that rights allow to occur. Okay. Let's talk about where rights come from, how they developed in our legal history. Because without the law, we don't have any rights. Because the law protects those. Now, legally, not philosophically, but legally, our rights in this country come from our Creator. It's announced in our Declaration of Independence that our rights come from God. You don't have to believe in God to have rights. But legally, that's an important concept. Why? Why is it important, legally, that your rights come from God? Anybody? Yes. Correct! Because if they come from God, no one can take them away from you. They cannot be stripped. We have them as our very being of a human being. The fact that we exist as humanity grants us these rights. And it's not a theological concept, it's a legal one. The same way as when you have the sovereignty of the United States outside the government. These are important legal concepts. They're not religious. I mean, you can attach a religious overtone to it, but we're just talking legally as a result of the fact that in our Declaration it says these rights are endowed to us from our Creator, means government can't take them away. And that's an important legal concept. Excuse me. Okay. What is the concept of right? It's a relatively recent one. Where did it come from? If you read, you probably one of those subway students, if you read the commentaries of people who take out philosophy on rights, they tell you that in the ancient world, the concept of rights simply didn't exist in the individual. People were not endowed in ancient times by the government with rights. At least their governments didn't protect those rights. Actually, you could argue they were always endowed because we're all human beings. Theoretically, God didn't change, so as a result of that, we may have always had them, but governments didn't respect them. When did that change? Well, the first step was what we talked about last week. Remember when William the Conqueror brought feudalism in? That was the first step. Why? Because you started to develop a reciprocal oath with your landlord. You were the person who was responsible for the care and feeding of my family, and I was the one who was responsible for doing the work on your land.
that reciprocal oath became the earliest moniker of the concept of rights. Because for the first time, it wasn't just the guy with the biggest club able to rule you. You had a consent issue there because somebody owed you something for the work you did.
That was the first concept of rights. It got expanded, and I would say in an earth-shattering way, with the Magna Carta. The Magna Carta came out and literally started as the Charter of Liberties. You could call it the Charter of Rights, because it enumerated the fact that you as people, and I know it only applied to free men who are not capital, those were landowners, okay? But it said that they had certain rights that the king had to respect. Okay. And what were those rights based in? What was the Magna Carta about? Give me a little help. What was the Magna Carta focused on? And rights in what? What is this class? Very good.
Property rights.
That's what the Magna Carta is. Okay. The common law,
that's where this all comes together. That's why we spent that first class doing it. The common law, started by Henry II,
okay, John's father, who created the Magna Carta, the common law embraced those rights, recognized those rights, and defined them and protected them. Now, go back to Greece. Greece was the first step here.
Because for the first time in human history, they came up with a concept that people themselves could govern themselves. That you had a value in your own individual person.
Then Rome created a complex legal system that gave a significant boost to that because of the law. Remember, it was eternal. Then you have England with William the Conqueror bringing all those reciprocal oaths. Then you have the rise of individual rights in the 13th
century. 13th century starts 1215 with the Magna Carta, goes to the Fourth Lateran Council, where the Catholic Church, which was the big boy on the block at that time, turns around and starts recognizing rights in individuals. He did not do that before this.
And that concept became a theological concept. It said the individual was important, and they viewed that for the purposes of saving their souls. Okay. 13th century rolls around, English jurisprudence comes in. Then you have the Age of Enlightenment, the Age of Deep Thinkers, people who sit around on a big stool and think deep thoughts.
Long time ago, I was Deputy Attorney General of the state. I was in the office of the Attorney General, and his campaign consultant came in. He was a charter of delegates in New York City. He said, surrounded by 500 lawyers. He literally was laying on his back with his legs in the air, thinking deep thoughts. One day I walked into the Attorney General's office and said, you know, it's rather odd and difficult to watch this gentleman with his legs in the air thinking deep thoughts. I said, what did you do that's so deep? He turned around and said, well, that's pretty much cool. Deep thoughts can be important, but beware of people.
Who were these deep thinkers? They were not the guy sitting in the rug doing push-ups. They were Thomas Aquinas,
who was a cleric, born to a very prominent family in Italy. He came up with the concept of grace.
And what developed out of that was the fact that the individual has a relationship with God. More importantly, that evolved because back then kings were viewed as divinely important. So if you had an individual relationship with the guy upstairs who appointed your king, you pretty much had to have an individual relationship with the king. Thomas Aquinas had a breakthrough thought with grace. Guess what? That turned into the moniker that started rights. Anybody ever heard of Occam's razor? Any scientists in the room? Very good. What's Occam's razor?
Never going for complicated explanations
of
phenomena,
just
a simple explanation
would work fine. Exactly. Simplest explanation is usually correct. Occam was a cleric. He also did all kinds of genetic experiments, usually by plant life, so you're not worried about what exactly is required.
But William Occam was also a philosopher. He was the first to really enunciate the concept of rights in people.
He wrote theses on it, and really should be credited as the number one guy. Then you had John Wycliffe, and then you had Locke. The social contract theory, the definition of right, and then the ultimate definition in John Locke. Okay? That's the evolution. You study that chart, you need to know, that's everything you need to know. Okay. What is a right? What has it been defined as? Go to Blackstone. Remember? What did he write?
No.
What did he write?
The Bible of the law! Blackstone's commentaries. It was the number one source. The Google of... You go to Blackstone, you know what it is. Right? He was the one who collected all the cases.
And what does he say? What a definition of right. Okay? He says, the word right represents the closest English translation of the Latin term just. Remember, words have meaning. Where does just come from for our Latin scholars? It's derived from the term get justice, right? But it means the whole embodiment of the law, okay? The most effective understanding of what the term right actually means, however, can be seen from the Scottish philosopher James Mill. Mill saw right in terms of a claim-based, legally justified expectation.
Remember those reciprocal oaths? You believe that your landlord was going to take care of you and make sure that you had the shelter and the food you needed to eat. He believed you were going to work the land. It's that expectation. Now, you're walking down the street. Now, please go through and come out of this car. For him or nothing. You think your rights are going to lie. You're nothing, right? Yeah. Why? Because you have the expectation of the Lord. That's right. That expectation constitutes that right. According to God. Okay. An easy definition
to concretize this is the legally recognized ability to exercise power or control over an action or an object. I'll repeat that. The legally recognized ability to exercise power and control over an action or an object.
That can include yourself. Okay?
That's the basis of liberty. Okay. With respect to property, property in terms of rights is reflected in three types of property rights. Rights in land, which is real property. Rights in objects, which is personal property. And rights in ideas, which is intellectual property. Okay? Property consists of rights in land or anything attached to the land.
A tree growing out of the land is real property.
Okay? It's attached to it. The water running under the land. The oil you have in your backyard.
That natural resource you have, that is part of the land.
Okay? The airspace above. Okay? Personal rights. Anything you own. That is chattel, personal property. Okay? There are certain exceptions.
The law, and we'll get into the detail when we go to personal property, but the law doesn't allow you to sell somebody you're getting. It's a public policy exception. Even though you own that kidney, it's inside you, you cannot turn around and sell it. Now, the law allows you to give it away. You can donate it, but you cannot sell it.
Okay? So it limits your property. Also, wild animals in their natural habitats.
Okay, not caged in, not in a zoo, but a wild animal. They and me running free is unowned. They are not being owned. Now, in early common law, they were deemed as property of the king. Under modern law, nobody owns them. Okay? And it becomes an important concept in law because they're really the only thing out there that's unowned. Everything else is owned by somebody.
Okay. Lastly, intellectual property, patents, trademarks, and copyrights. We'll go through this in detail in a few weeks. But they're rights and ideas. This is one of the most important areas of rights.
Because without property as a concept of rights, not as a concept of things, intellectual property can't exist. Because you cannot hold an idea in your hand. So unless you have a right to that property, intellectual property doesn't exist. And it is the engine that drives the modern economy.
Okay. Why do we have property rights? Well, it's a way to manage and maintain our society and our property. Justification, first in time, first in right.
I'm the first one to have it. If I capture that wild animal, it's mine.
Secondly, labor. There's a generalized acceptance that people should be entitled to the fruits of their labor. If you work for something, you should be able to have that come back to you. Utilitarianism, economics, it's a good way to make sure that maximize wealth for everybody. And lastly, liberty and personhood. Remember, that comes back to the fact that we're endowed with those rights. Okay. The first postulate, as I said, property needs to be seen as a collection of rights, not as a collection of things. Okay? Number one. Okay. That's the first postulate. Okay. Property rights are fundamental to our freedom and liberty. They're inherent as free people. Okay. Let's get to the second postulate. To that, we need to look at not only John Locke, but also Jeremy Bentham. There's a conundrum in the law.
Anybody know what a conundrum is?
Very good.
There's two great legal philosophers out there. So, one is John Locke. The other is Jeremy Bentham. They were both interesting people. They both had
interesting ideas, but they had different perspectives on life. John Locke is the father of natural law.
He believes that all concepts in the law flow from our humanity and our relationship with God. Our founders were very much natural law aficionados. Jeremy Bentham, on the other hand, is what is known as a legal positivist. He does not believe in all the concepts of natural law. He believes in some of them.
But his concepts are that the law seeks just to protect the common good, and that property is a means to an end. It's practical. Who was Jeremy Bentham? He was a legal scholar and a jurist, child prodigy.
His father came in and taught him reading Latin at the age of 3. Rather odd child, even then.
We are going to see his auto icon in a moment. Okay? He was very strong politically.
Had many interesting and some very good political views. At a time when women were not advanced to the same degree of political strength as men, he wanted political equality for women. That's a great thing. It came about well after his death. He was a trailblazer on that.
Okay. He believed in individual and economic freedom. He offered philosophy on many areas of law concerning property rights, but he also had some rather odd ideas as well. Some good, some bad.
But one of the basic concepts he said is he looked at the law reflectively. He examined it kind of like through the eyes of science and said, what is the law telling me?
Well, with respect to property, he said something which I think is quite brilliant. Property and the law are born together. Before laws were made, there was no property. And take away laws, property ceases.
I would dare say you should say that with rights, too. But remember, property is right. Very good. Property and the law was born together. That's true. Why do you have laws? To protect your property rights. One of the fundamentals of the law. They grow together. Why do you have changes in the law? Because property changes.
Take away the law, and who's going to protect your property? Comes people with clubs again. He's right on this. This is where we get the second postulate. Law is the foundation of property rights. Property rights exist only and to the extent that they are recognized by the legal system. That's a paraphrase of what he said earlier. Before we go, I also want to tell you on the University College, that's where he taught. If you look inside, there's a box,
University College, where you can go still talk to this day to Jeremy. He decided that he didn't want to be buried. I told you he was a wheelchair. Instead of being buried, he decided to sit in this box, or have someone to sit him in this box, and put glass around it. And to this day, he's hanging out at the University College in what he has called it's essentially a black case where he's sitting there, that's where I have. But he's there, kind of shriveled up. Doesn't look as good as Lennon in this black case.
Anyway, okay. But he's not red. Okay. Okay. What is our second postulate? Property and the law are born together and die together. Before laws were made, there was no property. Take away property and the laws.
Simply said, property and the law are intertwined. They grew up together. Without one, we don't have any.
Property rights are dependent on the law, and the law was created to protect our property rights. Okay. Third gate. We need to really focus on rights on this one. When you have that circular relationship, the property rights flow from the law, and the law evolves from property rights, we need to see property in that light in the relationship of rights. That's why we need to look to the founders of our nation. Our law comes from the founders. The basis of our government and of our law in the United States is the Declaration of the Constitution. Remember, those are the roadmaps, those are the rule books for our law. What do they say about property rights? What do they say about the founding principles? Okay. First, let's go to Locke.
John Locke, more than any person, had more of an influence on the founding of our government than any other philosophical leader. He was a brilliant lawyer, and all of the founders knew him backwards, forwards, and inside out. He published a landmark book in 1690, known as the Two Treatises of Government. Who's read it? Raise your hand. Very interesting. Hard slog. You have interesting reading nonetheless. Who else? Very interesting. It's on Google too, because that copyright has expired. 1690 was quite a while. I've actually read it. I know I need to get out. But it's good stuff. Please, that's a great topic. 1690, he writes this, and he comes up with a powerful argument that we all have rights endowed by our Creator, self-proclaimed, self-declaration, where we 80 years before, that we have three rights: life, liberty, property. Locke writes this about the fact that you have these three rights. And the two treatises goes on at nauseam to explain it. All of our forefathers wrote it. The Declaration of Independence was written by a brilliant lawyer. Where's Jared? There you are. Stand up, Tom. Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence. Stand up, John. Right. Which is the best friend in the room? John Adams. They went into a room in the top floor of an apartment in Philadelphia and scratched this out. Every once in a while, you shared it with one of your buddies, Benjamin Franklin. You went through several redrafts, but you were the best writer of all the founders. I mean, people saved almost everything you wrote because you're so talented, so well reasoned. Sometimes, but they thought they were one of those guys. Particularly since you had one of the brightest lawyers go over your work. He actually did not go over his son. So did they. But one of your problems was, Tom, as elegant and well-reasoned as you are, you're also, you can sit down. Keep standing. You're also a plagiarist. The most elegant part of the Declaration, which we can all say on heart, you copy. And, to your credit, 3 weeks before you died, you did. Thomas Jefferson took John Locke almost verbatim. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. that were endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, right out of two trees. Boom, boom, boom. Now, why did you substitute pursuit of happiness instead of the exact comment, pursuit of profit? Anybody know? Anybody have it? Anybody? Well, that question was asked of you a couple weeks before your death. Remember, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams died on the same day, July 4th, 1826, 50 years to the day of the Declaration. Actually, the Declaration was actually passed by Congress on July 2nd, but nobody remembers that. Okay? They remember the day that the scribes went on the top, which was July 4th. That's why we celebrate July 4th. John Adams wrote a letter home to his wife. July 2nd is a day that will be remembered by the entire world, now and forever, celebrated with fireworks. Well, you were off by 2 days because you didn't know the guy was going to wrote July 4th on top of the document. But on the day that he passed away, you were supposed to come to Philadelphia and give a speech, but you were rather long in the tooth. You said, I don't know that I'm going to make it that way, I'm kind of in bad health, can I send a letter? What do you think they said to Tom? Of course. Okay? And people read that letter in Philadelphia on the 50th anniversary of the Declaration. And in that letter, you responded to questions. And one of the questions people asked was, what's going on with your substitution of pursuit of happiness with pursuit of profit? Okay? How come everything is verbatim, almost lifted word for word out of two treatises, except for that? You wrote back, I didn't have to have a copy of the two treatises when I was writing it. And I thought that sounded better, but it's the same exact thing. You can't have happiness without pursuing property, that's what I mean. You specifically said there is no difference. Pursuit of happiness was your way of saying pursuit of property. And if you look back on the debates, because this was actually an act of Congress, the Continental Congress, they talked about that issue, and they decided that the pursuit of happiness was the pursuit of property. Remember, it's those three fundamental rights: life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Ladies and gentlemen, you just put in property and happiness, they're the same thing, they equate together, and the law finds that. What does this mean? It means that we're endowed with these rights as human beings. Property, and our ability to exercise control over that, is in the fundamental document that started our country and our legal system. That pursuit of happiness is the pursuit of property. Not property itself, the pursuit of it. And there is a difference. What it comes down to is government that was established by this declaration, and that is the fundamental document that started the establishment of the United States and our legal system. Okay? They decided when the bonds of affection are so strained that they must be broken to create a new government. The revolution said, we are breaking from you, England, and creating our own government. That's what the Declaration of Independence did. And it said that this government is going to protect three rights: life,
liberty, and property. And that as the protector, it's not the grantor. These rights are yours as human beings and can't be taken away. Okay? All this happened in the Great Hall. You go to Philadelphia, I urge you to visit it. In a small little room. So what is our third postulate? It comes out of the Declaration. Property rights are inherent to our humanity and endowed to us by our Creator. And again, I stress, it is not a religious issue under law. It is a legal concept that you as a human being have these rights, that government is required to protect them in you, and government cannot take them away from you. Now, how then can somebody be put in prison? How then can somebody be given the death penalty? If you were endowed with these, the government can't take it away. The law views that as you took it away by your actions, and that the government can impose punishment upon you by taking that because of your actions. We'll get to that when we talk about the criminal. Okay. Property rights as such are part of us as human beings. Okay? Now, this third postulate was not just announced by a declaration, which is the fundamental document of the founding of our country. But those of you who become constitutional scholars will understand that the Constitution is derived from the Declaration, and thereafter incorporated therein by reference. We'll get to that. So what about the Constitution? Does it confirm this? The birth of our government started with the Declaration and then was carried through with the Constitution. This happened 11 years after the Declaration. You had 1776. The Revolution actually started in 75 with Lexington and Concord. By 1776, in July that summer, the Congress was represented by every single state then in the colonies. Anybody know how you have to be a representative of the Continental Congress? Did you run in a congressional seat where you're directly elected? Anybody know? How about that? Anybody? How do you think you were elected to the Continental Congress? You were elected, and this comes into importance later in the Constitution. You were elected by the state legislature. Your individual colonial legislature would elect you and send you to the Continental Congress. So if you were from New York, the New York colonial legislature would say, you gotta send you. You were from Virginia. Virginia said, you gotta send you. Okay. This becomes important because in the Constitution, how were senators first elected? By the state legislatures. Same procedure. Get the sense, Tom, you guys are copying all that. That's okay. It's a good way to operate. Okay? If something works, don't fix it. Okay. 1787, these guys come together. 11 years after the Declaration, you have a revolution where lots of people die. We beat the greatest power on the face of the earth, the greatest military power ever known. We have a revolution, and they win it. We're operating under the Articles of Confederation. That means every state gets a vote on every issue
then it has to be unanimous. Those of you who are married, those of you who will be married, understand that unanimous never happens. Okay? Unanimous never happened in the United States government under the Articles of Confederation. Everybody realized it was broken, including our buddy, what's your name?
James
Madison. James Madison. Okay?
James Madison gets it. You can sit down, Sam. James Madison gets together with his buddies. One of them
was Alexander Hamilton. Alexander Hamilton was a smart guy. Lawyer. Financier. Immigrant. He comes from the West Indies into America. He's an orphan.
And he's a New Yorker. He gets together with you working on a canal deal.
Now, I understand a lot about history. There's a lot I don't understand. But this is a story I don't understand at all. You go with Alexander Hamilton to a conference in Baltimore, building canals across the United States. You get a resolution passed amongst these canal builders that you're going to hold a convention in Philadelphia to revise the Articles of Confederation. Now tell me, how the heck a group of canal builders have the legal authority to revise what was in effect the Constitution of the United States? Guess what? You decided it doesn't really matter, just get them there. You passed this resolution of Baltimore at this meeting that had nothing to do with nothing.
And a convention decides to be held there. Then you lobby everyone you know across the United States to send delegates to this convention that had no legal authority to be convened.
But you have an ace in your pocket because one of your buddies, one of your pals, was the most respected man in America who looked upon you as a son. George Washington, and he decided to go. And once he decided to go to this convention, everybody followed suit. Hey, George Washington's going to go there, I'm going to go there too. Good enough for Georgie, enough for me.
So they all pile in this convention, and what is the first thing they decide to do?
What's the first resolution? Kick out the press. Put a gag order. Nobody can talk. They literally nailed the windows shut in that small little room in Philadelphia where they wrote the Declaration 11 years before. You know, I know we have minor sensibilities, but I can't help but thinking, sick in the mind that I have, how smelly that room is. 100-degree temperatures of these guys in real long coats. I got it.
They go to this room in Philadelphia. The first thing they do is to vote to kick out the press. The second thing they do is vote to totally scrap the Articles of Confederation.
Now, even you, in your really gutsy, I have to substitute that word, move in Baltimore, said you only wanted to revise the Articles. Isn't that what you sold it to everybody as? The second resolution. First they kicked out the press, the second thing was, we're scrapping it. Doesn't work, it's scrapped.
Form all kinds of committees. Enter center stage. Jimmy, brilliant lawyer, gifted orator, very quiet, thoughtful, soft-spoken, disciple of Jefferson. You're a Virginia. You're willing to compromise. and you have a concept
known as the Virginian plan. Because he's got such a quiet voice, he goes to this fellow Virginian, and back then Virginia was everything. It was the biggest state by almost two times. He's a Virginian. He goes to all of you and says, guess what? I can't speak on everything you want to do. He wants others to advance his plan. So you go to George Mason and others who are there from Virginia to advance the plan. Who is sitting in the chair presiding over this Constitutional Convention, listening to them, smiling and nodding at you? None other than your buddy, your pal, George Washington, giving his sign of approval to everything you're doing.
The Virginia Plan flushes out the general concepts of what's going to become the government. But the number one legal concept that you advance, and it's the one that's in there today, is that the sovereignty of the government rests outside of the government. It's the only time in human history that the sovereignty of the government did not lie within the government. What does that mean? When you have a king, he's executive power, he's the sovereign. A dictator, even a legislature, in other times, the sovereignty rested within one of the branches. Not under Madison's concept. Under Madison's concept, the people are sovereign. It comes back to Tom's concept that we're endowed with these rights and that the people control the government. Okay?
Now, that's a goofy picture of me standing in front of Jefferson's home.
He goes before this convention to his house in Virginia and studies literally hundreds of other governments and makes these arguments to his fellow delegates at the convention of how the government ought to work. He cites the Declaration. Jefferson's not in the room. He's in France as ambassador to France. You write to him often, but back then it took 3 months between the letters, not exactly Federal Express. Okay? So you're on your own, but you do so much reading. You have a partner in crime, and that is our buddy from New York, Alexander Hamilton. He and you debate everything. Stand up, make compromises. He's far more of a monarchist than you are. You don't want any monarch. He basically says, we ought to take England's government transplant here. Okay? But you are a gifted politician. And you compromise. You come up with what we have as Constitution. But one of the things you won't compromise is this concept of sovereignty. And it goes back to rights. They're interrelated. In having the sovereignty of the people, what has to be done with this Constitution? It's not just that Congress approves it in this convention. Indeed, Congress, ruling body in America, the Articles of Confederation, until this is passed, doesn't even get a vote. Who has the rights? The people! So who has to ratify the Constitution? Is it Congress? It's the people! It comes down to rights. In order to justify this concept, you and two other gentlemen, Hamilton and Jay, write letters to the editors repeatedly in newspapers.
know them today as the Federalist Papers. You're arguing, literally, I think it's over 100,
diatribes, if you will, about what is important about free government, why we need this. You lead, as we talked about last time, the Virginia Ratifying Convention, and you get Virginia, the biggest player on the block, to ratify. You're an amazing, amazing guy. Okay? Now,
one of the biggest problems of ratification came over rights. The people of the United States said, hey, how come our rights are not enumerated in this Constitution? It just sets up the government. It talks about Congress. It talks about the bicameral legislature. It talks about the president. But there's very few rights contained within the Constitution. There's a handful. There's a handful, but not many. There's a handful of rights if you're accused of treason, what the procedures are. Plus a little bit about due process of law. And incidentally, due process of law was a concept that came out of New York State. It was first enunciated in the New York State Constitution and has become one of the fundamental pillars of the law.
But you turned around, James. You got that done because you promised ratification would lead to a Bill of Rights
that we'll put in the Constitution as soon as Congress gets together. You said, form the government, we will do a Bill of Rights. Now, those who were opposed to ratification said, no, you got a cart before the horse. We're going to turn around, we want our rights before we want our government. Because of George Washington, because of the Federalist Papers that you wrote, James Madison and Alexander Hamilton, the people accepted it. And even New York State, which was opposed to ratification rather strongly,
caved in and ratified it. The very first Congress, what's the first thing you did, James? You did a Bill of Rights. You sent 12 amendments.
Well, not 10, 12 minutes to the people for ratification, the Bill of Rights. The first two were not immediately ratified. That's why the Bill of Rights, as we know today, has 10 minutes. Because only 10 of the 12 were ratified. One of them was actually ratified in the 1990s. So we got a lot. That was not the 1990s, and it literally has nothing to do with our rights. But anyway, labor tax policy.
Here's what it is. Okay. Ratification is not a foregone conclusion. We look at it today, but many states had opposition. And the Bill of Rights was the fundamental issue.
And all of that. Number one issue within the Bill of Rights was property. Protect it.
Property rights are throughout the Bill of Rights. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. Our first capital, once the government was created, was New York City.
New York was the first capital of the United States. George Washington gave his inaugural speech, the first one, right by Wall Street, Federal Hall, where the first Congress met. New York City was number one.
That's where the Bill of Rights came out of, and everything was a first. You're looking for property rights in that Constitution? Look at the Ninth Amendment. The enumeration in this Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people.
What are those rights? Life, liberty, property.
That's an incorporation by reference. that enumeration in the Ninth Amendment folds in and has legally been found to be where the Declaration comes into our Constitution. Okay. So we have three postulates to start off with. One, property is a collection of rights, not a collection of things. Number two, property and the law are intertwined. They're interrelated. Without one, you don't have the other. They evolve together. And three, property rights are inherent to our humanity. They're endowed to us by our Creator. What's the last postulate? Equal. I like to use the golf analogy. I've been told not to play golf in public. I've never had an old golf ball. I hit it far away, but it generally in the woods. What is E-put?
E-put is an expression of your rights in property. Four things. Exclude. Now, exclusion has been viewed as the fundamental property. Because if you have the ability not to allow somebody to use your property, you now are going to control it. And the only way you can exclude somebody is if you're controlling it. Okay? Possession. Who here has seen Finding Nemo?
Me!
That was Bert?
Me!
They possessed it. They want it. Okay? Possession. Use. If you use something, you're physically controlling it. The fact of usage controls it. And lastly, to transfer it, to give it to somebody else. Transfer is a fundamental right.
That's the fourth postulate. Your property rights are summarized by E-put.
Exclude, possess, use, and transfer.
If you want to do well in this class,
know these backwards and forwards. No one passes the class without knowing you. Those of you who know I want you all to get it. But these four postulates are the most important fundamental basis of property law. You understand this, you understand everything. And we will fold everything into it. Property is a collection of rights, not a collection of things. Property and law are intertwined, they grew up together, evolved together. Without one, you don't have the other. Property rights are endowed to us by our Creator, they're part of our humanity. And they can be summarized by E-put, exclude, possess, use, and transfer. Okay. Now, I need you to come down, take a case, take a cookie, take a break, then we'll do a case and get you out of here. Take cookies, guys. Can't take them all. Chocolate chip, non-chocolate. Here, there's others too. Oh, yeah. Get a case, though. Just because I want it, guys.
Sure. Please come down and sign it. Playboy. Somebody who wishes to be
what we would call in this day and age a billionaire.
You want to go the frontier route? You want to go the
reality show, Ralph, for that day. You kind of hang around and talk with your rich friends and do some things that rich people do, whatever that was that day. But one of the things you love to do was to get all of your other wealthy friends together on a weekend and go for a pot hunt. You had a rather spacious estate the pot bought for you, and you would arrange these pot hunts every weekend, get all your friends on horseback, someone would catch a fox and bring it, and let it run. And one day you're on your estate, they release the fox, they release the hounds, and you start running. Away. Chasing that fox, as you do. Your silly cat, friend next to you, that little people, chasing the fox. Now! Go chase fox. Jesse, please come forward. Jesse and his family are pillars of the community. His father is a preacher, so is he. He's also a school teacher and a farmer. Very respected, but not particularly wealthy family. Okay? Good side of the floor. Then you have the farm falls next to our friend Lovett. Okay? Quite a bit of property, but, you know, there's not a lot of them. They have all the sailing ships or any of the farmer or teacher deposit. Okay? Now, as a farmer, what are foxes? No. But what foxes did, they were vermin. They would kill things you do like eat, like chickens. Okay, you like your chickens, they taste good. Foxes, you didn't like foxes. They killed your other livestock. Okay? That's not a good thing. So if a fox comes onto your property, you're going to say, I don't want you on my property. What are you going to do? Exactly. So a little fox is being chased towards your property by none other, come on, guys. Then one day, and all his fancy friends, okay? They are chasing the fox. He goes on to the beach, which is public land. Now, you don't see lovely and his fancy friends, but you do see the fox running towards your chickens. You have two thoughts. First, I want to kill the chickens and eat them, not the fox. Secondly, this is Jesse, who likes a nice fox hat. Fox hats. Great. I like her. So what are you going to do to the fox? You turn around and shoot the fox and carry it away. He skinned and turned into this cat. Okay? So, Mr. Pearson shoot the fox and carry it away. Go away and skin the fox. What do you think of the guy taking your fox and carrying it away?
Man.
You don't like it?
No.
Okay?
No.
But unlike your father, who's a pirate, probably would have shot him, you're a second generation. You lived here for your generation. See? So what do you do? Exactly! Lawyer number one, come on over. You complain to your lawyer. That's what we do. Common law is lying well in America. You go to your lawyer and say, that nasty man took my box away. Sue him and get my box back. Okay? How do you sue somebody? You draft a summons and complaint. We're very sophisticated in our language of the law complaint. means just what it says. Means I'm complaining about your actions under the law. If summons means just what it says, it means come here. You've got to come to court and answer this complaint. So you, legal eagles, are out. Shut up. And you serve it on our friend, Mr. Pearson. Okay? You go sit over and do legal stuff and you go. Now, you got served with someone to complain. What's the first thing you do? Hire a lawyer! Very good, I like that answer. Come on, lawyer number two. And come on up. When you get served with a summons and complaint, you come here and answer these complaints for you under the law. What do you do? You draft a response. What do you think they call that response being that sophisticated in the world? An answer! Sounds good to me. You draft an answer to that, go serve it under by the lawyer. Okay. Now, lawyers, you can go take a break. I need you. Come on over. Ludwig and Jesse are now in court. And this becomes a rather big deal in Queens. Because two of the most prominent family members are fighting with each other. But in our new America, in our legal system, they're not fighting with fisticuffs. They're not fighting with guns, they're not burning each other's house down, they're fighting through the legal system, they're suing each other, they're litigants. You say you shouldn't have taken my box away, give it back, you're saying the same thing that those birds say in Finding Nemo, go on to me. Go stand over and talk about other things like the local cricket thing. Okay. Lawyers, judges, come on up. Okay. Next. Lawyers are making these arguments to our two distinguished jurors. Come on up. In our first case, they bring this action and say, I want my box back. This is my box. I was chasing it. I want it back. Think about it. We know the families. We know one, very prominent. We know the other one's got money. You decide I'm going to go on the side. Okay? And you say, guess what? Give him the box back. What? That's what she said. We're in court. You say, give him the box back, that's my decision. Okay? It's a well-written decision. You say he's chasing it. That's his property. He doesn't. Listen to that. What is the first thing we do when we lose a law case? All players have diamonds, lose their. We appeal! Come on forward again. You say I shouldn't lose. You say, hey, I won. Come on up. You are the accuser. Who writes this thing? Pumpkins. You are telling me that. You're pretty distinguished now. You know what? You know what? But you know what? Huh? No? That is not winning. Girls, my grandmother is a suffragette. You know what that means? My grandmother fought for the right to vote. She was that. She was one of 11 brothers, a legal. My grandfather turned around her and said, my daughter is far more capable of understanding everything than any of my sons. As an argument. Okay. Let's talk. You go on to become Vice President of the United States. One of the reasons is this thing. Because you really, really And what you say is a concept of as much as you give it well-reasoned opinion, you say, he does not have to give the box back. Exactly. It's a wild animal. And who owns wild animals?
No one.
Until someone controls it. Taking that box, mere pursuit, is not possession. The fact that you chase someone doesn't make you yours. If I really like a car and decide to chase after it, it's not mine. The fact you're chasing the last one means that it's not yours. There could be an exception. What if Ludwig had all of this happen on his property and not on the public? You address that, brilliant judge. Brittany addresses that, as Judge Hutchinson says, if that box was all contained within Ludwig's property, then he would have no right to shoot it and take it away. Why? Because even if he could go on that land, it would be trespass. He can't go on his property and take something off of it without your permission. And he certainly didn't have permission to shoot it from you. Okay? So if that was all on his land, you said he couldn't shoot it. But it wasn't all on his land, was it?
So
he did, but then he let it go. What happens is, we'll talk about that. When you have a wild animal, if you have it in a cage, or keep it on your land, it is yours. But once you let a wild, not a domesticated, not your puppy, not your chicken, once you let that wild animal go, it reverts back into its unknown state. Unless it exhibits a habit of return, like a carrier pigeon, or a dolphin, it comes back to visit you. If it's flipper, maybe it's still dead. But the fox was running for its life. It was trying to get away from you. It wanted to go back to do foxy things. So you can't say it was under your dominion and control. And remember, what's the number one thing about exercising your property rights? Control. He doesn't have it. Goes back to being a wild animal. You, on the other hand, exerted control over it. He killed it. That's pretty much ultimate control of that wild animal. And you turn away and turn it away. So guess what? You exerted control over it. Guess what? Box is yours. Go take your seat. I'm sorry. You won at the lower case, but lost your appeal. Good lawyers. You did an excellent job. You won below. Not your fault. Lost on appeal. Good job. You won it on appeal. Okay? Go take your seat. You wait. What Justice Thompson said in this decision is brilliant. Because it describes property. Why does the law have somewhat of an obsession over wild animals? It's because they're worth a few things that don't own. So you can actually get control and possess it. How did you do that, Mr. Pearson? You shot it and carried it away. Had he captured it in the cage, he could have kept it too. But remember, there's conflicting property rights here. Had that happened all on their property, he would have said, I controlled that scenario on my property right, so it's still my box. That's the way the original judge saw it. He said it didn't go on his land. But guess what? Once that fox crossed into mutual territory, you were protecting your chickens. I would suggest this time that the number one reason you wrote this, however, was because what was the number one profession in America at the time? Farming! And what don't farmers like? Foxes! So when you go side with the guy who's throwing foxes on the people's property, or on the farmer who's protecting his chickens? Good decision. See you next week.